Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Cap Radio's politics reporter, Nicole Nixon, sitting in for Randall White. California's regional stay-at-home order is over. This morning, the Department of Public Health announced it's releasing all regions from the order and allowing counties to go back to the previous tiered system. This gives counties more control over their local COVID situations. This also means most counties will return to the purple tier, allowing more businesses to reopen at limited capacity. The regional stay-at-home order was put in place in early December as a way to track and measure ICU capacity so that hospitals would not be overrun with patients who need care. The Greater Sacramento region was released from the order last week, but much of the state had not because ICU rates did not meet the forecast 15% threshold, which is raising eyebrows this morning. Many people are asking why Governor Newsom is releasing the regional stay-at-home order when some areas of the state are nowhere near the 15% ICU capacity. And his administration has not released the metrics of how those numbers are forecast. We hope to learn more about the rationale behind today's move in a press conference and the Q&A that follows today at noon. Cap Radio will broadcast that press conference live, so we hope you'll join us. Meantime, the recall targeting Governor Gavin Newsom is escalating in California. While it's not uncommon in the Golden State for residents to seek a recall, these rarely get on the ballot and even fewer succeed. Several recall efforts have already been launched against Governor Newsom. Those obviously failed. But this latest effort, which got an extended deadline to gather signatures due to the pandemic, stands a realistic chance. Joining us now with more on the recall, the process, the precedents, is Professor of Political Science in the College of Arts and Sciences at University of Redlands, Renee Van Vechten. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Well, the big news this morning is that the state is ending its regional stay-at-home order, which most of the state has been under for 6 or 7 weeks now. The State Department of Public Health says this is because the ICU projections are above the 15% threshold 4 weeks from now. There is frustration because that data is not made public, like I mentioned. So do you see this decision, Renee, as data-driven or is it political?
Well, it's probably data-driven, but I'm sure that you can't get away from the political ramifications for keeping these stay-at-home orders in place for as long as they've been. So clearly it's got to be data-driven, but the fact that they haven't released those numbers, of course, raises questions in people's minds. And it does feed a little bit of that conspiracy theory that might be sort of floating around in people's heads. Really, why is there an ulterior motive here? And it could be political. There could be some politics, like I said. If you're a governor, you don't gain any kind of political capital by keeping your state closed or keeping businesses closed and putting people at further risk for financial ruin. So surely there is some political incentive to do this as quickly as possible. But given his track record, I don't think that the governor would actually try to keep these measures in place if we really were putting more people at risk.
Well, this seems to be sort of a double-edged sword because since the onset of the pandemic, Newsom has claimed to be data-driven in his decision-making. Democrats have largely approved of Newsom's handling of the pandemic. But when there are big decisions like this and we are not able to see the data behind these decisions, does that hurt his credibility with the public?
Well, certainly it could. And even if the data were out there, it's a little bit fuzzy, right? Most people don't know how to interpret this kind of data. There may be conflicting data. So even if the data were out there, it's not entirely clear that people would buy the story that it's purely data-driven. And I think that because of the way that that this has been handled over the past few months, there are questions about when you actually want to shut down and when you want to reopen and what sorts of businesses can be open and which should be shut down. So those kinds of legitimate questions about what is truly safe are really driving people's questioning of the governor.
Yeah, and we have had a lot of changing of the criteria over the past year, you know, what is shut down and when, what businesses are included in these tiers. And I've talked to business owners who I know are very frustrated about that.
Mm-hmm. So, right. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I would say that if anyone in the state, any constituency is particularly irked by this, and not just irked, but truly aggravated. It's the business community in this state. They already feel as if this state is inhospitable to business, and then add it to that all of these restrictions, which truly have been devastating. It just makes for a really tenuous kind of relationship that they have to California itself, but also to the governor, and it feeds their real angst.
Well, you talked to me for a story that we ran this morning about the recall effort that Newsom is facing. You said that he could potentially survive a recall if he avoids any major blunders. Based on the reaction to this announcement this morning, what do you make of this? Is this going to help Newsom, or is it going to hurt him in the long run?
Well, it turns out that if this recall actually does succeed, and there is a good chance that it could succeed, that the signature gatherers have until mid-March to gather signatures, right? And it could qualify, but they do need to get past that really high hurdle, which is really not just 1.5 million, but it's got to be more than that, because quite a few of these are going, these signatures will be invalidated. So say somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 million or more. Imagine that we reach that threshold. Then we enter a period, of course, in which the governor's got to actually run to retain that seat. Anything could happen. Imagining that the recall goes forward, the governor doesn't want to have or create any blunders. But I suppose there's also another scenario we could discuss, which would be just an accumulation of errors. And if the political environment were to change, and enough really just, as I say, kind of the errors build up, and people are just frustrated overall, and everybody's got a different reason, but, you know, it all adds up in the aggregate to this person is incompetent and has blasphemed against us, has created a kind of situation where we just feel like we can't get out of it unless we replace him. Well, then clearly it could turn, the environment could turn against him, and the atmosphere could clearly turn toxic for him, and he could contribute to that in a whole number of ways. One would be a big blunder or a series of blunders, and the other would be a series of blunders.
Well, recall organizers have to submit all of their signatures for verification to election officials by mid-March. Walk us through the process after that. When will we know if this recall actually does make it on the ballot? And when could a recall election take place?
The county officials should be already verifying, and some of them have been verifying, mm-hmm. some of those signatures. So that process takes quite a few weeks. And then if and when we would know would be, I think it's about a month later, we'd have a little bit of time. And then this governor has to call an election once those signatures are verified. Within 60 days, he has some time to call the election. But we're really talking about end of summer if we had a recall effort, an actual election take place. And right as rain, it will be, if it happens, it would be an all-male election, with, as we saw, in the kind of vein that we saw in November. Hmm. So all male, but also the chance to vote in person.
Okay. And if this does get on the ballot, you were telling me that Newsom would have one advantage as far as campaign spending. How would that factor in?
Right. So a recall election is actually two different questions. And the first is a ballot measure. And the ballot measure itself is, should the governor be recalled, yes or no? The second question is, who shall replace the governor? And so the governor, in defending his own seat, doesn't have any kind of restriction on how much money can be donated to him or spent by him. So they're, unlike the candidates who will be on the ballot to replace, they are subject to strict donation limits. So they can only accept about $32,000 per person, per individual who wants to donate to them. But it really is a different kind of bar for him. He has no limits. On the other hand, anyone can spend individually to get that message out however they want to. So independent spending has gone through the roof, as we've seen in the last few years in federal elections. It's always been the case in California that an individual or a corporation could spend whatever they wanted to, but the cat's out of the bag. And so, you know, most corporations and companies have already jumped into that game, and they've they've gone with it. So we see huge amounts of spending in these sorts of races anyway.
Well, this recall effort has people making comparisons to the last gubernatorial recall in California. That was when then-Governor Gray Davis was ousted and replaced by Arnold Schwarzenegger. I would love to revisit that. What happened then, and why was Davis recalled?
Well, Davis started off on a rather poor footing on the on his reelection. Davis didn't really ever come off as being a charismatic kind of person. I think I've described him and others have described him as being sort of wooden. And he was always the kind of person who wanted, he was a ladder climber, wanted to climb that ladder, and that he had his eyes on that prize. And he was a steady public servant in that sense. He just kept climbing all the way from being in, you know, in the legislature all the way up. But what he couldn't quite manage to do was capture people's imagination. Right? He just lacked the charisma. And so while he was also sort of making headway as governor, he was also gaining a reputation as being a pay-to-play kind of a politician. So he would, on the one hand, give these larded contracts to union representatives or to unions in the state, public employee unions in particular. And on the other, he wasn't asking for their donations, but was expecting it. So that kind of played into a negative view of him. By the second time around, we saw that for his reelection, he was actually only reelected with 47% of the vote. So he was already unpopular. He had a lot of negatives. The citizens of California were dissatisfied with their choices, and they picked him anyway. So Republicans and opponents saw an opening. And that as conditions in California worsened, as the economy sunk, as rolling blackouts happened, and as the car tax, as we entered into this terrible budget situation with about $35 billion in the hole, he tripled the car tax, which affected pretty much everyone, so most people in the state. So all of those really added up to a whole lot of negatives for him. And that opening, even though he had actually okay popularity, it really did kind of go off a cliff right before the election. And so then Arnold Schwarzenegger, of course, jumped into the fray along with a whole lot of other celebrities, Gary Coleman and Larry Flint and et cetera. But Schwarzenegger quickly rose to the top, and he'd already had some political bearings. So he emerged as a likely and plausible kind of replacement. That was really the stage that set the stage for somebody like Schwarzenegger to come in, slide in, and displace Gray Davis.
Well, you mentioned things that, you know, some of the circumstances of this last recall, some of them sound very familiar today, a big budget hole, rolling blackouts. What other similarities do you see, or how is this recall effort going to be different?
Well, actually, let's talk just briefly about the budget situation. We were predicting, or at least the Department of Finance had foreseen a $54 billion deficit coming into this year. And granted, we have just skyrocketing unemployment, about somewhere in the neighborhood of 9%, I think, still. But what is really interesting is that because of the way we structure our tax code, those at the top pay most of the tax. You know, half of the state's personal income tax comes from the top 1% in the state. They're doing quite well. And as it turns out, we actually have had more of a sort of windfall than we expected. So the economy while the economy is slowing down, the receipts coming into the state are actually not as bad as we expected. So that bodes well for the governor. The next budget will actually be fairly strong if those conditions hold, mind you. We don't know what's going to happen with the larger economy. But we also have some other sort of, you know, terrible things that could happen. I mean, as we go into summer, imagining that this recall happens, what happens when there are more wildfires and rolling blackouts, for example? Of course, in the moment, people will be quite dissuaded to re-elect him, I would imagine, if it affects many, many people. It really is about management. If there is some giant blow up with the vaccination rollout, you know, imagine that there's a warehouse somewhere and many millions of doses go to waste. I mean, that sort of thing will be pinned on him because, yes, the governor is held responsible for what happens in the state and on that magnitude.
One thing I did want to ask you about is this LA Times article that came out over the weekend highlighting some of the links between this recall effort, their organizers, links to far-right groups, anti-vaccine activists. Is this information surprising given the political landscape in California? And maybe second, as a follow-up, would this information change anyone's mind about signing the petition or supporting the recall?
I think that this is sort of a neither here nor there kind of an issue for a couple reasons. Well, sure, it's not surprising because a recall effort is going to be supported by the opposition to Newsom. And Republicans count many people among their ranks. But at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter if it's extremists or moderates or just run-of-the-mill Republicans who are supporting, because what really matters is if you can get enough people to support the recall. And there are, quite frankly, enough really just rational people who just are quite upset about how Governor Newsom has managed the state to make this kind of an effort succeed. So it's not exactly surprising, I suppose, but it's also a strategy that the Democrats are going to try to use to dissuade other Democrats from supporting it and dissuade those in the middle from supporting it, those non-party or nonpartisan, the NPPs, no party preference voters, who kind of swing however they naturally lean, but who in the last recall did, of course, support the recall of Davis. So in any potential recall, a governor must be mindful that he's got to maintain his base, but also make sure that he can maintain those who are in the middle.
Well, let's talk about that. One more question I want to ask you is how Governor Newsom is viewed right now more broadly. He has a relatively high approval rating. About 6 in 10 Californians give him an approval rating. He's still popular among Democrats. What do you make of this recall effort gaining steam right now with that, 58-60% approval rating?
Well, the fact that you only really need a couple of million people out of a state where we have 25 million eligible voters is actually not all that surprising. It is a high hurdle, but in an age of social media where this kind, and also just, we're on the radio, traditional media, where people are hearing the message, can go to a website, download that form and send it in. It's not surprising that you'd see this kind of an effort succeed. And since the 1960s, that is, since Pat Brown, every governor has had a recall effort launched against him. And it's sort of not surprising that we have a sort of tradition now of having recalls against governors. It is surprising, I suppose, that we haven't had more succeed. I would think that in the future, this will become slightly more routine, if only because we have people have the possibility of accessing those documents and sending them in very quickly.
Renee Van Vechten is a professor of political science in the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Redlands. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Up next, a closer look at the state of California's economy and unemployment and the impact the new Biden administration might have. Shoot us an email to insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Nicole Nixon, sitting in for Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Cap Radio's politics reporter, Nicole Nixon, sitting in for Randall White this morning. We just took a deep dive into the recall effort against Governor Gavin Newsom as he enters the second half of his term in office. There's no question that the backlash against the governor has only increased during the pandemic and amid stay-at-home orders that have left countless businesses shuttered and damaged the state's economy. California continues to see surges in unemployment claims, and officials still have to sift through a backlog of more than 800,000 people. Under the new Biden administration, though, more relief could be on the way. President Joe Biden has issued two executive orders aimed at the pandemic's economic fallout. The first would both increase how much families are given each week through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program and direct the IRS to ensure Americans are getting their $600 payments. The order would also let people claim unemployment benefits even if they quit their job because they feel unsafe working during the pandemic. The second order lays the groundwork for ensuring federal workers and contractors are paid at least $15 per hour and can access paid leave. Congress has so far passed two relief bills aimed at helping those who've lost their jobs. President Biden is pushing Congress to pass another $1.9 trillion stimulus program. Joining us now is Jane Oates. She's the president of Working Nation, a national nonprofit campaign that raises awareness about the challenges facing the U.S. workforce. She was also the former Obama administration assistant secretary for the Employment and Training Administration. Welcome to Insight.
Hi, Nicole. Thank you.
So how does the change in the White House, Jane, affect the economy as a whole? We're facing, you know, a new chapter here.
So I think the first thing that all of us probably feel very relieved about is that there seems to be a desire to have a national approach to ending this pandemic, an approach to getting the vaccines out, and an approach to doing it in an equitable manner. I think, you know, getting the vaccination program going and getting this virus under control is step one in rebuilding the economy.
The stock market went up, I think, 13%, something like that, since Election Day. And I believe that's the biggest rise in the stock market after a presidential election. Does the stock market typically go up after presidential elections? And why is that?
I think there's been mixed reviews on it. Sometimes when a president is obviously anti-business, you see some of the stock market people, the stocks really go down. But I think there's a real sense of optimism now with President Biden. And I think I hope that it translates not only to the people who are able to invest in the stock market, but also to the Main Street people.
Well, we mentioned it earlier to start this segment. President Biden has proposed a $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief plan. It seems that every time a new stimulus is proposed, Wall Street raises its economic forecast for the next 2 years. Does that mean that Biden's new plan is good for the economy?
Well, I think we have to wait and see what Congress does with the proposal. You know, there's always modifications that happen. But clearly, if people have enough money to not only pay their bills, but to take advantage of some of the things that happen as the economy starts to reopen, indoor dining, more shopping, I mean, clearly that's going to be a stimulus.
Well, beyond easing the financial strain for Americans through expanded unemployment and stimulus payments, what sort of longer term economic impact would a new relief bill have?
Well, I think it's going to give Janet Yellen, the new Secretary of the Treasury, I think it's going to give her lots of ways to look at how to repair the inequities that were exposed during this pandemic. So that means getting capital into small business owners' hands, certainly helping all businesses, but particularly businesses that were so hard hit, those women and minority-owned businesses.
Well, President Biden has said he wants to raise the national minimum wage to $15. As a reminder, the federal minimum wage is $7.25 right now. That would more than double the minimum wage. Do you think there are trade-offs to raising it that high?
Well, look, I was very happy that he did it for federal contractors. That's a great start. I mean, clearly, I worked in Congress over a decade and saw several attempts to raise the federal minimum wage. It is clear that the federal minimum wage is too low. Nobody should work full time, 40 hours a week, and still live in poverty. That's immoral. But the question about how do we get this to move forward? How do we make sure that small business owners, micro business owners that have just family members or just two or three employees are protected? Those are the kinds of discussions that have to happen. And I certainly feel that we're in a position to have those adult conversations. But without a doubt, the federal minimum wage today is just too low.
Yeah, well, in California, the minimum wage just increased to $14 an hour at the beginning of this year. Do you think that that might be part of the reason the cost of living is more expensive here on the flip side of that?
Well, you know, I think that it's a chicken and egg question, really. But what you bring up is so important, Nicole. It shouldn't be about sensitive and forward-thinking local areas going to raise to a living wage and then having businesses move out of them. There should be a national effort to raise the minimum wage to a standard where people working full-time live comfortably.
Is there any data or evidence showing what happens with people working? Because one of the arguments against raising the minimum wage from where it is now at $7.25 federally is that it would cost businesses a lot of money and they would have to lay people off. Is there any data to back that up?
You know, there has been no evidence at all looking back that businesses have had to go to those draconian measures. And quite frankly, we can look at businesses today, businesses like Amazon and Walmart, who have made that move to a higher wage nationally, and they continued to hire. In fact, both of them hired several hundred thousand people during the pandemic.
Well, as far as the Biden agenda goes on the economy, are there any proposals that you find interesting or that you think would be helpful right now?
Well, I love the tagline, right? And I think all of us do, Build Back Better. So it tells us that we had a great stance before we had hit this pandemic, but we don't want to go back to where we were. We want to go back to a place that's more equitable, that's fair, and has better opportunities. So I really like all of his proposals. You know, many of them need congressional action. So he's going to have to use all of his incredible skills from his decades in the Senate to make sure he can convince people there that these are the way things, the vision is right, and they can help him tinker with the details of how to do it. But clearly, more training, more investment in Pell Grants, looking at debt-free community college. I mean, those are all really good things and put our country in a wonderful position for the 21st century.
Joe Biden was vice president during the recovery from the Great Recession. What are some of the policies that helped the recovery back then? And would Biden be able to translate those to help boost this economy amid this pandemic?
Well, he was integrally involved. You know, as you said, I was at Labor, and he was incredibly involved along with my secretary, Hilda Solis. So the things that he did, first of all, he led with compassion then, and I think he's going to do that now. I was with him and with Dr. Biden, his wife, numerous times when we met with unemployed people in the Midwest, particularly, which was so hard hit in the Great Recession. But he had real answers for people, and when he didn't have an answer, he came back, he did his homework, and he went back to them later. So I think, you know, that recession is going to, we're going to look back very different, disproportionately impacting manufacturing, whereas this economic downturn is disproportionately hitting, you know, retail and travel and tourism. But I think he has a great team around him, great advisors. I think we're going to get some good answers.
Jane, what are your biggest concerns for the U.S. economy post-pandemic?
So my biggest concern is labor market participation. Right now, we're seeing people just sitting out of fear, absolutely, out of fear about getting the virus. I don't doubt that. But we're going to have a concentrated effort to talk people into getting back into this economy. And we're going to have to target it to women. I mean, the status of women in the pandemic is frightening. Today, only 46% of the jobs that were lost by women from February 2020 on have come back. That's opposed to 60% of the jobs for men. You know, construction jobs have come back, manufacturing jobs have come back, and the jobs that women lost many of them are not coming back. Every week we get a new negative. You know, I mean, last week it was Godiva closing all their domestic stores, but we've seen major retail outlets where women were able to not only work, but build a career. So I think whatever we do, we're going to have to make sure we talk people into coming back. We need all of their talent to rebuild the 21st century economy that we want. But we really have to make a targeted effort with women, particularly young women, particularly young women of color, who right now have the lowest participation rate in a 32-year history.
Jane Oates is the president of the nonprofit Working Nation and is the former Obama administration assistant secretary for the Employment and Training Administration. Thank you so much for joining us, Jane.
Thank you, Nicole.
Well, millions of Americans have claimed unemployment insurance after losing their jobs during the pandemic, not to mention thousands of non-citizen workers who haven't been eligible for these benefits. Joining us now with more on unemployment benefits under the Biden administration is the state of unemployment in California right now is Stephen Levy. He's a senior economist at the Center for Continuing Study of the California Economy in Palo Alto. Welcome to Insight.
Hello.
Stephen, the unemployment picture in California varies by region. Help us make sense of the numbers. What areas of this state are struggling the most right now?
Well, the whole state is struggling because we have imposed, I think correctly, activity restrictions in order to really mitigate the impact of the pandemic. Southern California and the Central Valley, I think, have higher unemployment rates than, say, Sacramento and the Bay Area, but I wouldn't make it who's worse. I would act to try and revive the state economy. And the person you had on earlier said the correct thing. This all starts from controlling the virus, from distributing the vaccine, from hoping the vaccine works, and from eventually being able to reopen over time.
Well, how would President Biden's plans, both economically and on the coronavirus, you know, vaccine deployment front, how would that change things here? How much will these help?
I think Biden's plan will be especially helpful to California. In the short term, you want to eradicate the virus. So you want to go strong on getting the vaccine out and helping states and community organizations distribute the vaccine as quickly as possible. The other thing in the short term, since the jobs aren't going to come back anytime soon, is to make sure the unemployment benefits get out. We have a major problem with that in California. EDD is struggling to process unemployment claims and get the money out. And so that really hurts the families. And to, as Biden has suggested, increase the amount of short-term aid to people who have been laid off. But the major, I think, programs will be in the long term. One of them is immigration reform. California has always benefited by being a welcoming state for talent from around the world. And that has been just truncated by Trump in recent years. So we want foreign workers, we want foreign students in our universities, we want visitors to feel welcome here. We want foreign trade to be revived. We are a major trading state. I think the second thing that's long-term, that's big, is the infrastructure program that can not only build our capital stock, improve people, improve transportation, but also create jobs, and that's going to take a lot of money. And just being a more welcoming partner on the world scene so that people from around the country, around the world, feel better coming here, trading with us, making deals, and investing here. So infrastructure, immigration, and a welcoming global policy.
We will be talking more about immigration in our next segment. A few more questions for you, Stephen. With the money that California has, how long can the state support these hundreds of thousands of unemployed workers? It costs a lot of money.
It does. But the first thing is to get the money out that people are owed. A lot of the money is coming from the federal government. In a crisis like this, you need to do what people need right now. I don't think this unemployment is a long-term issue. I could see us opening up fairly aggressively in June and in the second half of the year. I think we need to be talking about how to build a California that's welcoming and works well for everybody in the second half of the year. At some point, the vaccine will be gone and the unemployment will be much lower.
Well, let's talk about getting to that point. Some experts and economists say that the economy cannot recover until consumer confidence recovers. How do you restore consumer confidence in a pandemic that is very contagious?
Well, we've seen several bouts of pretty strong consumer confidence. People who have money are spending it. I think you beat the vaccine and you open up stores and hair salons and gyms and restaurants, especially restaurants. They've been the hardest hit. And I think people will come back. I think consumer confidence is also will be improved simply by having Biden in office. I think people will feel that we finally have leadership in a direction in the state. So I don't worry about that. I worry about getting the vaccines out, getting the unemployment aid out. I think in 3 or 4 months, things will be looking a lot better.
Stephen, how long do you predict it could be before we are back to where our economy was around this time last year, pre-pandemic?
I think best guess is probably early next year. That would be very good. But I think what's important to people is not the level, but it's the direction. If we start adding jobs and adding income and the unemployment benefits get out there and the additional aid that Biden has proposed for food stamps and other things in the short term get out there, that people's moods will be affected by the direction and the momentum, not so much the level.
Stephen Levy is a senior economist at the Center for Continuing Study of the California Economy in Palo Alto. We really appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts with us.
Thank you.
Still ahead, how President Biden's new immigration plan works and what it might mean for California and our economy. Shoot us an email to insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Nicole Nixon in for Randall White. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Cap Radio's politics reporter, Nicole Nixon, sitting in for Randall White today. President Joe Biden, on his first day in office, sent Congress an extensive immigration proposal, one that is expected to have big implications for California and its economy in particular, which is home to the largest undocumented immigrant population in the country. The plan, called the U.S. Citizenship Act of 2021, would notably provide a path to citizenship to the 11 million unauthorized immigrants living in the U.S. About 2 million of them live here in California. Kevin R. Johnson is the Dean and Professor of Public Interest Law and Chicana-Chicano Studies at UC Davis School of Law. He joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
Well, lay out the basics of this plan. It doesn't sound like it would grant immediate citizenship, but it is a path to citizenship. How would this work?
Well, there's a number of paths, actually, for different groups. There's a shorter path for recipients of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals benefit and for temporary protected status recipients, that is, people who fled El Salvador, Haiti, and a number of other countries because of unrest and climate problems. That length of time to U.S. citizenship would be about 3 years. For undocumented immigrants, generally, it would be probably closer to 8 years. So it depends on which category you fall in as to when you might be able to become a U.S. citizen.
Well, this plan still needs to work its way through Congress. Of course, it's just a proposal right now. But as it stands right now, would this, if it does pass, would there be a protection for undocumented immigrants? Would they be shielded from deportation if it does pass between that moment and becoming citizens? Is there anything like that?
I think there would be a process where they'd be permitted to apply. And while their application was pending, they wouldn't be subject to removal efforts, absent some criminal or other problems. But they'd be permitted to stay while the system ran its course and decided whether they were eligible for relief. It would be very unfair for them, to apply and then to be thrown in removal proceedings and removed from the country before their relief could be decided. So I think that the application process, as well as the pathway, would give them some peace while their application is pending.
A path to citizenship for 2 million undocumented immigrants living here in California, I mean, that would be huge. If this plan does pass, what do you think some of the most immediate impacts of that shift would be?
I think, as we've seen in PATH programs allow a path to legalization, you see efforts made by many people to apply for legalized status. And once that status is obtained, then you can expect them to have more freedom in the job market about what jobs to work at, to avoid any possible exploitation of that market because of their immigration status. And I think that ultimately, they'll have other rights that U.S. citizens do, including to receive public benefits, to serve on juries, to vote, and to become full members of our society. Currently, many undocumented immigrants are residents of our society, are members to a certain extent of our community, attend churches, go to schools, or work, but aren't full members of our society. So a pathway to citizenship status in some ways is a pathway to full membership in U.S. society.
Well, what about economic impacts? We have the largest undocumented immigrant population in this country. These people often work, what are seen as the less desirable jobs. Would we see big economic shifts if suddenly we have a large group of people becoming citizens?
I think we may see some economic shifts. We may see some incredibly beneficial ones. We may see more young undocumented people getting a pathway to legalization and getting the skills and educational training that's necessary to fully participate in our economy. I think that we are likely to see some people who are currently undocumented and working in the farm labor industry or domestic service industry or in restaurants or hotels possibly move out of those jobs. But that's hard to say. To the extent that a path to legalization allows people to improve their skills, improve their competitiveness in the job market, and become more contributing parts of our economy, that probably is better for all of us.
Well, what about deportations and enforcement? You touched on that a little bit. If those are slowed down significantly, what would this mean for the Department of Homeland Security and ICE?
I think over the last 4 years, we've seen a transformation of the Department of Homeland Security and a transformation of Immigration and Customs Enforcement to focus on immigration enforcement almost completely. I think that there's much else that can be done in terms of working with the immigrant community, including encouraging lawful permanent residents to naturalize and become citizens, become full members of our society, and to devote efforts to serving immigrants as well as deporting them. I think that we're not talking about a dismantling the Department of Homeland Security or a dismantling of ICE. We're talking about possibly redirecting resources to different parts of that agency. And one of the places where we are in great need of resources are in the immigration court system. And that's housed outside of Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice. But we have a backlog of over 1 million cases, actually 1.3 million cases in the immigration courts. And we could certainly use some resources devoted to more immigration court judges, more time and effort spent on adjudicating those claims as opposed to simply arresting and seeking to deport more people.
Real quickly, is that funding diversion included in this plan, or is that, would that have to be something separate?
I think that it probably have to be something separate, but it's something that certainly is on the greater agenda. And there's going to be, we have the proposed U.S. Citizenship Act. As you mentioned in your opening remarks, this is the beginning, and I think a long discussion of immigration reform. And I think that it's a much needed discussion. And I hope we can have a reasonable and rational discussion, because there are very important policy decisions to make and very important important issues to be resolved. And we're not going to do that by yelling and screaming. We're going to do that through working together and trying to come up with the best plan possible.
Well, this is still an ambitious political feat. It would likely require some support from Republicans to pass in Congress. Do you think that the country is ready for a debate about immigration reform, especially after this harsh and frankly racist rhetoric from former President Donald Trump we've had the last few years?
I think that the country is ready for a rational discussion of important issues. We've seen a mass removal campaign over the last 4 years, and we still have millions of undocumented immigrants living in the country. It's clear that immigration enforcement now, immigration enforcement forever, is not the answer to our immigration issues. We have to come up with a system that makes sense for us economically, makes sense for us politically and socially, and some hard decisions have to be made. And I think there are some legislators in the Republican Party who are open to immigration reform and have supported immigration reform in the past, including people like Senator Lindsey Graham and Senator Marco Rubio, who have supported immigration reform proposals. And President Bush supported immigration reform proposals. So I think it's an issue that hopefully we can have some discussion. I think the nation's ready for the discussion. And I think that we're going to have to work hard to get reform passed, but I certainly think it's possible.
How do you think the debate has changed since the last immigration reform attempt that was in Congress? I think it was in 2013. It passed the Senate, but died in the Republican-led House, if I'm remembering correctly. Has the debate changed much since then, or will this be kind of a repeat?
I don't think it'll be a repeat. We've seen 4 years of the most aggressive immigration enforcement in modern United States history. And we are where we are with as many problems now as we had when those efforts started in 2016. I think we have to have people sit down at the table and think, what is good for business? What's good for agricultural in the Central Valley? What's good for our hotel industry? What's good for our construction industry? What's good for undocumented immigrants? And what kind of enforcement makes sense without going over the top by separating families, putting kids in cages, and things that many Americans found out about and were genuinely shocked by. So I think one of the very positive things we've seen over the last 4 years is an attention to immigration and the human impacts of immigration that we really didn't have a good feel for in 2013. But I think now they've been driven home in the hearts and minds of Americans.
Real quick, I've been curious about this, Kevin. Is there any data about immigration and border crossings during the pandemic. Do we know whether that has slowed or by how much?
Well, I think that I can't tell you precisely how much it has slowed, but they have slowed. And they've also slowed in part due to the economic recession. And one of the things that you see in immigration trends is when the economy is doing better and there's a need for workers, particularly low and medium skilled workers, you see upticks in apprehensions, upticks in undocumented migration. When the economy is not doing so well, you see sort of a leveling off. And after the great recession of 2008, immigration tapered off for a few years, then it increased as the economy improved. And now we're seeing, with the pandemic and the economic impacts, we're seeing sort of a decrease. It goes up and down at various points in time. And some have said, and I don't know if it's true or not, that President Biden his election has spurred more people to come. I think that bad economy means there's going to be a lot fewer undocumented immigrants coming.
Kevin R. Johnson is the Dean and Professor of Public Interest Law and Chicano Studies at UC Davis School of Law. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
That's Insight for today. Learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Our technical director is Mark Jones, and engineer is Antonio Muniz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. I'm Cap Radio's politics reporter Nicole Nixon, sitting in for Randall White today. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.